So for me, the solutions really are about finding projects that give double-digit returns, finding projects that help people to be part of the solution, and finding projects that help people to invest in a way that aligns with their values. So that for me is really about growing wealth, making an impact, and leaving a legacy.
Welcome to season 3 of the Here Together podcast. We're your hosts, Charles Matthews
and Kelly Roberts.
We are obsessed with the big question. Can we live together sustainably? And if so, how?
Over the next year, we're curating conversations with the people who are living in eco-villages, designing new cities, inventing or rediscovering low-impact technologies. We're talking with these people who are at the forefront of sustainability science and design to get answers for us and for you.
This episode, we're really excited to talk with someone who is leveraging the inexorable power of capitalism to actually make positive change. Seems counterintuitive in some ways to me, but I believe this. I believe in this.
She exists.
She exists. We're speaking with Dr. Dionne Payne, and she's the founder of High Impact Property Investments. Dionne specializes in raising capital for organizations that create ethical property developments in Australia and the United States. Dionne is a speaker, author, and property coach who loves creating win-win outcomes for as many people as possible. Her goals include socially responsible investment, affordable homes for everyone, building resilient communities, and ending homelessness. And Dionne has a PhD in natural products chemistry.
What?
And has product managed a number of property developments in Australia and has helped over 30 investors to achieve double-digit returns through property. I was lying in bed last night. This is a sign of me like becoming middle-aged and finally understanding what you're supposed to do with your life. Lying like, okay, so what? How long does it take to double your money if you just make a 10% return? And it's faster. It doesn't take that long. Double digits sound awesome. Anyway, her projects range from small ones to large co-living projects.
Welcome, Dionne. We're so excited to talk with you. We have so many questions. I can't even.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here. And you know what? I just wanted to work out that how long it would take to double your money. I have a feeling that it's 7 years, but I just wanted to double check that. So I'll do that later on.
That's what my 4 a.m. mathematics said. So
awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very slow number crunching, doing a lot of multiplying and adding in my head at 4 a.m. But yeah, do you want to show
yes.
it? Yeah.
Yes.
Question number one.
Since a big part of sustainability, our favorite subject, is sharing, we want to know, did you have to share a bedroom growing up?
Yes, I did.
And how did that go?
That is so left field.
We like to start at the heart of things.
Oh, that's fantastic. Look, I'm the eldest of 6 children, and there were 4 girls and 2 boys. So my parents, and we lived in a 3-bedroom house, and my parents had the big, mummy daddy room. My sisters and I slept all together. So we had 2 bunk beds in the middle room, and my 2 brothers slept in bunk beds in the smaller room. So yes, I did share a bedroom, and it was interesting that the age difference between myself and my sister is 4 years, I think. She's an 81 baby and I'm a 78 baby. No, that's my brother. No, she's an 84 baby. So there's quite a difference in age. And it was annoying because I'd have all of my stuff and my sisters would be in my stuff. I love my sisters. I think they're great. But sharing a bedroom wasn't the highlight of my childhood. Let's put it that way.
Well, right. Sharing amongst 4 is like, that's a crash course. That's a like graduate level course in sharing.
Co-living, yeah.
Do you know what though? I can sleep anywhere. That's probably one of the good skills that I got from that period of time. I can sleep anywhere. I can fall asleep, get in the car. Within 2 seconds of driving, I can fall asleep. I can fall asleep on trains. I can fall asleep on planes. I don't have any issues with sleep. So that's probably because of that.
That is fantastic.
Yeah, that's a superpower that I wish I had for sure.
Yeah, I'm an only child. And so now I'm like, oh, that's part of my problem.
Yeah. So, you know, we ask this question, you know, in part because we know that there's all of this kind of psychology and sociology about how we live together. You know, Kelly and I live, you know, two people and two cats in a relatively kind of a big suburban home. It's not a McMansion, but it's more space than we need. And we know that that's not a sustainable way to live. So trying to figure out how to prepare ourselves for not four people on bunk beds to a room, but something in between. But we're just really curious to, you know, to kind of get a little bit more serious for a bit. You know, what is your definition of ethical property development and how does that relate to sustainability?
Oh, look, that's a fantastic question. My definition of ethical property development is really about creating solutions in property that include as many people as possible. I'd love to say include everyone. I don't know. That seems like nirvana at the moment. And also there's probably people that don't necessarily want to be included in that way of living. But I just wanted to make it accessible to people that want to be part of that system and not necessarily prescribing that everybody has to fit into that.
Got it. So something that I noticed, this is a little bit out of left field maybe as well, something that I noticed is that the UN Sustainable Development Goals don't specifically say get everybody housed, which surprised me. But I know that, you know, in the US at least, the cost of housing materials, the inefficiencies for heating and cooling homes, and the breakdown in the social structure caused by our current housing solution, quote unquote, the suburb, are, you know, they're really big parts of, or that sector really needs to change for sustainability in the US. And I'm just kind of curious if you're seeing the same thing in Australia and what it is that you're doing to make that change in that sector.
Yeah, cool. So one of the big things that we're seeing at the moment is that the way people are living has changed. So, you know, we're all sold the big house and a lot of homes at the moment are bigger. The yards are smaller. The houses are bigger. But we're finding that there's actually a lot more people that need one or two bedroom accommodation rather than four bedroom accommodation. So we've got a lot of these big houses where the space is not being used as much as it could be. Because of that, we're also seeing a lot of people not being able to find affordable accommodation and therefore sleeping in their cars or camping in unsafe situations or couch surfing, all comes under the umbrella of insecure housing. And with that, there's a lot of trauma. So there's a lot of people who are, because of that insecurity, because I'm sure there's a lot of feelings of sort of lack of self-worth mixed up in that as well. Like, you know, it's one of the most fundamental things to be able to put a roof over your head. And if you can't even do that, then what pressure must people be putting on themselves? And I've spoken to a few people, particularly older women, women over 55, who are in the situation where they're moving from place to place and they don't really have a fixed address. And yeah, I do recognize that there's a lot of trauma in that situation. So I think, you know, there's a couple of things. There's been able to provide people with homes that actually match the way that we're living. So building more one and two bedroom properties is really important. So there's a lot to do around this. And I certainly can't do that all and I'm not qualified to do all of that. But what I can do is use the skill set that I've got, the creativity that I know exists in the property industry, to be able to provide solutions. And that part is really exciting. I can't say that I can necessarily fix the trauma, but, you know, I certainly know people that can. So I think it really is a collective effort, and it's not just about building the physical structures. It's about helping people to rebuild and love themselves again and be able to contribute again.
I love that. Kudos to you for just having, you know, going into this financial kind of world with that awareness of the whole issue. That's a really beautiful.
Can I just say something else?
Yes,
to that?
Absolutely.
I just also want to make the distinction. Like we're seeing homelessness in a lot of people, but our perception of homelessness is often, you know, sort of like the man on the street with like raggedy clothes and holding out the hand to beg and what have you. But that's actually, I mean, that's part of it, but that's not the whole of it. We're seeing professional people that can't find somewhere to live. We're seeing nurses and teachers and paramedics and firefighters and police. In Australia, we have a term, key workers. So those key workers that are working in a particular community, they're not even able to find accommodation. And here's a really funny thing as well. So the one of the, you know, there's all sort of development approvals that you have to get to be able to build. Now, our local council that is in charge of doing these development approvals, they can't even find the staff to be able to do this because the staff can't find accommodation in the area that we need to provide these homes.
Catch 22.
Big time.
Classic.
Big time.
Yep.
And it's not just the council, it's the restaurants and the bars and the cafes and all of these people that rely on sort of lower paid workers. Because the lower paid workers can't live here, then they're struggling too. So it affects us all. It's not just a, you know, sort of a poor person problem.
No, we're housing insecure ourselves.
Yeah, we are.
We're on a month to month rent in a booming housing market. We're frankly quite surprised that the owners haven't sold the house already. And if we were to lose this lease, there's nowhere in this community that we could afford. They only started building multi-family or multi-unit housing in the last 2 years.
Yeah, quote unquote affordable housing.
Yeah. We're sort of victims of the mentality of the development mentality that focused on single family homes, you know, over 1500 to 2000 square feet, you know, spread out all over the place. This is not sustainable housing that's being built in our community.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Mm-mm. But, you know, the exciting thing about that is that there's an opportunity to go in and retrofit those houses to make them more available to do co-living. So, you know, imagine having two families living in the house that you're in at the moment. So, you know, you can split the house and there's all sorts of really simple things that can be done to make it so the house is actually full of people, but everybody has their own private space. There's communal, there's ways to be communal if you want that as well. But there's an opportunity to go in and retrofit a lot of houses to cater for this market. And that's quite exciting too.
That's fascinating. We'll have to look out for those. So you started off, you spent, I'm guessing, a lot of time getting a PhD in natural
chemistry.
Products chemistry, right?
That's right. Yeah.
That doesn't have a lot to do with housing development.
On the surface.
What drew you away from chemistry to being a housing coach and property developer?
Oh, well. Look, that's a really interesting story. So I would say that the similarities between the two things are all about service. I remember being at school and a friend of mine said, you know, I'm going to be a doctor and I'm going to find a cure for AIDS. So like we were kids in the 80s, 90s. And I was like, that is really cool. I'm going to be a doctor too. And I'm going to find a cure for cancer. So, you know, we went off and we did our studies and I didn't end up doing medicine. I parted a bit too hard in the important 2 years of school to end up doing medicine. But I did. I did end up doing a pharmaceutical chemistry degree, which meant that I was able to work in the pharmaceutical industry. And after I graduated, I did that for a year, couple of years. And I actually worked for quite a large pharmaceutical organization. And I loved the work. I loved the science. I loved the discovery. But I didn't love the way that they treated their employees. And I really felt that I was like this little cog in this big machine. And other than the department in which I worked in, who were all really lovely, the big sort of machination didn't really know or care who I was. So, and I didn't like that. I didn't like feeling insignificant. So I then went to work for a smaller company. And I also remember one of the first things that I learned when I did my chemistry degree was about cannabinoids in the brain and in the body. So you've got cannabinoid receptors, which are perfectly suited for, you know, cannabis, the molecules from cannabis. And, you know, being a student and, you know, doing all of that kind of experimentation, I was like, man, that's amazing. Our bodies were designed to have cannabis. Now, I'm not promoting the use of cannabis, although I'll come back to that in a later stage. What I did get from that, though, was that natural products are important. My grandmother was always, you know, very much into natural remedies, and she had this really stinky, disgusting concoction that if we were ever sick, she'd be like, here, take some of this. And, you know, it'd be horrible, but we'd be fine. So I had that affinity towards natural products. And so I ended up working for a natural products company, ended up working for another one, and then ended up doing my PhD in natural products chemistry. So that was that journey. But like I said, at the heart of it, it's all about serving people. When I finished that, though, I was in my 30s, early 30s, and I knew that I wanted to have children. I knew that there were two paths that I could go down. One was to continue doing research and do the postdoc and then become a professor. And that was a big dream of mine. And then the other part was to have children and have children biological clock won over. So I left to have children. And then I was in the position of living in this community and not being able to find affordable housing. And in fact, that was like 12, 15 years ago, and it was difficult then. So, and we were on a single income at that time. My husband was working and I was at home with the kids, and we just thought, we've got to find a way to get into the property market, which means that we can, because right now we can't. And so that led to education, and we did a couple of property courses. We found a joint venture partner who had more money than time, and we had lots more time than we had money. So we formed a relationship, and we did a couple of projects together, and it was the easiest money that I've ever made. So coming from that academic, you know, sort of struggling to get grants, very competitive, to I've just done a couple of transactions and we've earned, you know, like our yearly wage from that. And that was the clincher for me. It's like, wow, this is amazing. But I have to say that the inspiration for that at the time, or the motivation, was really about doing it for us and getting our way into the property market. So we've done a couple of projects, and I saw a piece of land that had development approval for 14 one-bedroom townhouses. And I kept walking past it, and nobody had bought it. It had been on the market for ages. And I was like, maybe we can do something here. So I knew how to do a business case, and, you know, I did it all. And I was like, wow, we're going to make a mozza out of this. And what actually, the development approval was done in a way that they could get more houses onto the site if three of them were allocated for affordable housing and managed by a community housing provider for at least 10 years. So the developer had done all that work for us, and we just picked up the site and paid $100,000 less than what they'd actually put it on, because that was the only way we could make it work. And I brought some joint venture partners in, and we made it happen. And I remember in the research phase, because it wasn't as straight as we went out and bought it, I really had to prove the point before bringing other people on board. So in that research phase, I went out and I knew the local real estate agent who I'd, you know, worked with before. And I said, look, this site has come up and I want to just do a test campaign to see if this is going to work. So he did some marketing, and I just put a post on Facebook and said, you know, I'm looking at doing this. Is anybody interested? And the first person that responded actually ended up buying one of those properties and was one of the first people to move in. So it moved from a purely transactional, all about me sort of project to, oh my God, my friend's involved in this and other community members are involved in this. I better deliver. So that was where the social impact came in, because I thought, well, you know, being able to provide something, it wasn't just affordable rental properties, like the whole thing was affordable. We were selling these one-bedroom properties for $350,000 when the median house price was $600,000. Now, if we hadn't done that, my friend would have had to have left the area. She wouldn't have been able to buy a house in that area. So that was really the clincher for me. It was like, wow, I can make money and I can serve my community. And it was fantastic.
Wow. Yeah.
That sounds so good.
Okay, can I tell you the downside? Can I tell you the downside now?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Don't let us get float away.
Not completely. So I ended up picking the wrong joint venture partners. I ended up picking the wrong builder. I am very good at relationships. I'm not so good at the details. So, you know, there were things I thought we'd covered all the bases, and I thought my joint venture partners would, you know, be the details and I could swan around like, you know, like, yes, this is all going to be great. There were red flags there, like right from the beginning. We hadn't even signed the contract with the builder, and my joint venture partner and the builder just did not hit it off. And all the time I was like, no, it's all going to be fine. It's all going to be fine. And my joint venture partner, she was an accountant. And so her job, her task was to look at all the numbers. And she did really well, but she also managed to squeeze, like tried to get the juice out of everything, and putting that pressure on the builder. And the builder, you know, the builder was great at building, but there were other builders that I could have used that had more experience in that. But because I had that rapport with the builder initially, I thought, no, he's the right guy. Everything else was the same, but it was that kind of rapport that I had with him that really clinched the deal. Anyway, so my joint venture partner was squeezing everything for what she could get, which benefited me. So I didn't stand up and say, this isn't right. even though I kind of had this like, I don't feel good about this. And then the builder ended up going broke. That process was really stressful. And I ended up falling out with my joint venture partners. And it was just really hard. But because of all of that stuff that I'd said before, because it was something that was important to the community, we just had to soldier on. Like we really did. And, you know, the project got completed. We ended up making a 25% return on our investment per annum. So it was good money, did something good for the community. Even with all of that drama and pain and everything, it was a good result. But that kind of had a bit of a knock-on effect, all the drama, because I then left that project thinking, I am never going to work with anybody again. Like, I'm going to do this all on my own. And that was a bad move. Like, if I'd have actually gone in and sort of had a bit more awareness around why it played out in the way that it did and what my contribution was to that, then I could have avoided some mistakes that I made afterwards. But I did spend a long time afterwards just wandering around in the wilderness going, WTF, like, what actually happened? and obviously made that decision that I wasn't going to work with anybody again. I wasn't going to collaborate. And that was a bit of a downfall for next projects.
Right. Yeah. You know, one of the next questions on our list was, explain what you do as a property coach and consultant, but it's sort of like, learn from Dionne's mistakes.
Right. That's what I was thinking. Like,
that's what she's bringing to the project, having made some mistakes and figured out how to correct them.
Right. Yeah. The difficulties and the painful, situations that you just told us about have to really inform your coaching. And I can imagine that your clients benefit incredibly from those quote unquote mistakes.
Oh, absolutely. And I've got something that I call the ethical framework, which is how I evaluate projects and partners to bring on. And the E is for experience. So I really have to look at the investor's experience from the get-go. Now, it really depends on their level of financial literacy, the number of projects that they've done or the number of investment properties they have. The more down the track they are, the more experienced they are. So that provides a level of comfort. Now, if I see somebody that hasn't got that level of experience, I'll be really recommending that they get some education around this, because it's one of those things that's so close shop. Like, if you don't know anything about investing, like property investing or how developments work, you just don't have a clue. So really, part of what I do is about helping people get educated in how the property development process works. And then we really look at working with partners that have the track record. Part of that time that I was in the wilderness, I really attracted partners that didn't have that track record. They said that they did, but actually when you looked at it, they really didn't. And so seeing a developer that's gone through a number of property cycles, that's gone through the booms and has gone through the bust and is still standing, that's really important. That gives credibility, knowing that they're going to be much more risk averse, creative, but know how to be able to solve the problems that come with doing a property development as well. Also look for high impact projects. And because of that experience that I had with that townhouse project, I just really get the power of walking past something, knowing that you're doing a project for something bigger than yourself, knowing that it's an act of service. And when I've had that experience that you can get double digit returns and be able to serve your communities and the communities that you live in, I just don't see why you would do anything else. So, affordable housing is really important. Sustainable housing is really important. The IPCC report says we've got 10 years to be able to stay within that 1.5 Celsius temperature rise. So we don't have any time to mess around. Like, we need to be doing this now. I look at, building resilient communities. We've had a number of floods. We've had a number of bushfires. We've had a number, like the pandemic. How do you build communities that are going to look out for each other? How do you build communities that are more self-sufficient, that they're not reliant? Like, when things go down, when systems go down, that they can take care of themselves and take care of each other. That's really important. And then the other thing is for providing homes for people with disabilities, because there's a twofold thing here. Like, you do get people with disabilities and not being able to access all of their homes. That's, again, coming back to self-worth. That doesn't feel very good. But then, because we've got an aging population as well, all of the things that we're putting into place will have that double impact. It's, you know, it's really important to look after people and create homes now that will service those people later without having to do really expensive refitting processes. So that's your high impact. I is for investment risk, and then just making sure that the investors are very aware of their risk profile, because at the end of the day, it's all about being able to sleep at night. And then making sure that the developer has something in place that says, okay, well, these are the risks, and these are how we're going to mitigate those risks. So that's all taken care of. And then everybody can sleep better at night. The other is for collaboration. So after that, you know, period in the wilderness, I'm going to work on my own. I don't need anybody. I really got the power of collaborating with people who are not just delivery personnel, but really get invested in the project as well. So a developer that I'm working with at the moment, one of his collaboration partners, the architect, their firm is on track to be net zero by 2030. Now, when you've got collaboration partners that are invested in getting the same result that you are, that is really important. And, you know, one of the things that I learned in that time when I was on my own was that, you know, I cannot come up with all of the ideas and all of the solutions that are involved in a development. I cannot run a development all by myself. Not that I was trying to do it all by myself, but I definitely got partners or collaboration. I didn't get collaboration partners. I definitely had a collection of service providers. And that is a very different thing now, because they're there to get their paycheck and not much else. Aligned values is really important. That was a big lesson that I got from my first big development. And I knew that our values weren't aligned at the beginning, but I just thought, you know, we just got to focus on the money, just got to focus on getting the result, and then the rest will follow. It doesn't. It doesn't. It just sets you up for a fall and a really hard one. So working with people that have those aligned values is really important. And then legacy. One of the proudest moments of my life is every time I walk past those buildings. And when I sort of work with people, when I work with new people, I'll often, there's a cafe across the road. And I'll often say, let's meet there. And then, you know, we'll be talking. They say, what have you done? And I'll go, ta-da.
That's going to feel so good.
It feels so good because they look really good. I mean, the good thing about the builder is that he delivered the part that he did. He probably delivered about 60% of the project. So the impact of that was really significant. They look great. I feel this tremendous sense of pride every time I look at it. It's like, despite how it ended up, like I did that and I created that with other people, of course. But that's the thing. Like, it was so impactful. And when I speak to people now about working with them, I just need to mention, I was the developer that did this project. And because they understand, they recognize the impact that it had on the community, they're also like, wow, okay, that's really cool. That's kind of my opening to have that conversation. So I've kind of weaved in sort of my learnings in there and why I came up with the ethical framework, but it's also a really great way for investors to evaluate projects and teams before they start investing. And based on what I know and what I've done and people that I've worked with, when you've got all of those things in place, you maximize your chances of success. So I wouldn't want to invest in any other way now.
Thank you for listening to this episode, and thank you for joining us on this investigation into the question of our generation. How are we going to live in a way that can last? We hope you'll stay with us. So subscribe. It's free. It's easy. Just click the subscribe button on your podcast app to make sure you get every episode. We also invite you to join the community that's growing up around this podcast.
Subscribe to the twice monthly newsletter at here-together.us/join and come chat with us on the Clubhouse app. Clubhouse is this amazing, highly participatory audio-only social media app, and I love it. We're extending the Here Together experience there every week. You can join the Here Together Clubhouse Club. We're there every Sunday at 9 a.m. Mountain Time. If you're already on Clubhouse, search for and join the Here Together Club, and you'll be notified whenever we open the room.
It's easy. And if Clubhouse is new to you, don't worry. We wrote a simple Clubhouse user guide that you can find at here-together.us/clubhouse. We'll be having the same valuable conversations with people who are already designing and living the solutions, and you can join in. Ask questions, share your thoughts, and be a part of the Here Together community in real time.
Or you can just listen while you're doing the dishes. Whichever mode works for you is fine. Just join us.
And be sure to check the show notes for more on the podcast guest and related resources. It's easy. Just click the notes tab on your podcast app or go to here-together.us/pod for all the details, links, and what's not. Now back to the show.
So let me ask you, Dion, what would you think of as an ideal team for a project like this? Like, I'm an artist dreamer. I have all these big ideas and I want, you know, everybody to be happy and have a place. And but I'm also an introvert, so I don't really want to talk to people. I just want to dream stuff up and then I just want it to magically happen. But I know I need like somebody with money to invest in it and somebody with skills to build it. What roles are essential to a team that's going to do a development project like this?
Yeah, look, that's a great question. I would say, and I know that you asked me about team, but I think there's something that comes even before that. Having a vision, like having a really clear vision of what it is that you want to create, even if you don't know how you're going to get there. And then you enroll people because of that vision. And I know that this gets talked of a lot, and you know, it's kind of one of those things that we take for granted, but I've seen it time and time again. It's really important because until you're really clear of what it is that you want to create, and I'm not saying necessarily what it looks like, it's just, what do you want to create? Where do you want to be in the next 5 years? What do you want it to look like? Who do you want to attract to it? I spent quite a bit of time over the last year working in a business accelerator. And one of the things that they talked about was to really clearly define your pitch, know what you stand for, know how you contribute, have a big vision, have a big, hairy, audacious goal that you're going to get to. And then just the more that you pitch that, the more it becomes real. So my big, hairy, audacious goal is to raise $1 billion for ethical property projects by December 2026. And I remember when it first came out and I was just like, oh, did I say that? And I only said that to one person. And then I said that to my business partner. And bless his cotton socks, he didn't say, you know, that's impossible. He was just like, Okay. And then I said it to somebody else. I said it to a friend who kind of shot me down a little bit. It was like, that sounds impossible. But thankfully, I kept going and kept sort of speaking it. And then people kept reporting it back to me. And so that's the power of that initial vision in the first place and getting really clear and then pitching that to as many people as possible. And then what I found is that the right people will come to you. So that's the key thing, I think. But then on a practical basis, yes, you'll need an architect. Yes, you'll need somebody that's got development management skills.
Hang on, before you move on, I just want to say something to Kelly. So I just met Dr. Dion Payne, who's going to raise $1 billion for ethical investment by the end of 2026. Mm-hmm. Doesn't that sound cool?
That's exciting.
That sounds really cool.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. $1 billion by 2026.
I believe that she's going to do it,
for
too.
For sure. Okay.
Yeah.
Back to what you're saying. You know. No, really, that creates ripples, you know. Yes. that your big hairy statement, your big hairy goal creates in me the desire to talk more about it. If you had said I'm going to raise $10 million, I wouldn't have felt compelled to stop you and repeat it to Kelly, and I wouldn't repeat it to, you know, I'm going to talk to my friend Trace, like, oh, we just met this person who's going to raise $1 billion for sustainable housing. So I think I'm kind of getting the power of that audacious vision. A smaller vision isn't as
compelling.
It's not as compelling. Yeah.
It's not. And two things to talk to towards that. One is the reason that I came up with $1 billion is because I was raving to my friend about how, you know, you've got companies that are mining coal and how destructive it is. And you know, in Australia, we've got the Great Barrier Reef, which is this, you know, cultural icon. And then you've got companies that are mining and destroying the Great Barrier Reef. You've got mining companies that I'm not going to name names, but I'm sure you know who they are, who are blowing up sacred sites. And they are able to attract so much money when they're creating things that are not helping societies to flourish. So what if we just, you know, sort of pulled some of that money towards things that are not pie in the sky things, like property is something that's really stable. Like, we know how to do property. Why not divert some of that money into property? And then, $1 billion is really achievable, not by one person, but it's really achievable when you look at the vehicle to do that to, and to create that and what that money would be used for.
Yeah,
and
then, a billion here, a billion there. Pretty soon you're talking about real money. Yeah. And real change.
That is the thing, real change, because we have a homelessness problem. Would $1 billion help to end homelessness? I think so. If it doesn't do it all by itself, then 1 billion is going to be 10 billion, is going to be 100 billion. But then there's momentum to create that change. I mean, one of the things that I probably should do, I haven't done, is really quantify, well, how much money would it take to end homelessness? I think that's like another PhD study that I don't have time for right now.
Yeah. Well, it's probably less than we think. I mean, it's
it's a cultural change,
right,
more than a money change.
Right, a priority
change. It's a system change and a priority change. I absolutely agree.
Yeah. That's fantastic. What were we talking about? Well, I'm still stuck on $1 billion.
She was telling us about the ideal team. So we need a visionary and an architect.
Yep. So you need your architect, because they're going to draw the designs. And one of the things that we found from working with Gensler, who are the architect that have that net zero goal, they're living, breathing it. Like, trying to get an architect that doesn't believe in that, that doesn't have that big vision for themselves, that's really hard. Like, you go, and I've done this before. I've gone to somebody and said, okay, I want something, I want it designed, and I want it to be, oriented well, passive solar, cooling breezes, all of that. And it's just one of the things that they can quite easily let go of if it doesn't quite fit with the brief. But when you've got somebody that lives and breathes this and says, yep, okay, this is what we're going to create, then they slot really well on your team. So an architect, a developer, a development manager, somebody that's run developments before that also buys into that vision as well. And not just buys into the vision, but embodies it. You know, like, it's not just, we can do this. It's like, no, we live and breathe this. This is important to us. Then you need a builder. Then you need, your engineers. So that's your civil engineers, your hydraulic engineers, your structural engineers to come up with these plans. You need, financiers, you need people with money. But I tell you what, if you build the team and build the vision, people with money will come and enroll into it. But you need to have a credible team. So one of the things that I do in terms of raising capital is just tell the story of what it is that we're trying to create. So I'm just thinking of one example where a developer partner is building 72 bed rooming accommodation. So that's co-living on steroids on a big scale. Part of the audience, part of the target market is older women over 55, and part of it is young professionals, because those are the types of people that would be happy to have, the studio apartment and also be able to have communal living as well. When it came to getting investors on board for that, now this was probably the largest and first high impact project that I got involved in and got to talk to people and raising capital for. So, the numbers had to stack up. It had to be a good return for the investors. So we were saying, it's 20% return on investment. And we spent a lot of time trying to get the numbers right in the constraints that were there. And to do it in a way that everybody wins. So the developers are winning because they're going to get a good return. The investors are winning because they're going to get a good return. The community is winning because there's more affordable housing in here as well. So we got the number, and then there was the story. It's like, okay, before the story, the middle bit is really this is how it's going to be done. So this is the plan. These are the milestones. This is when you can consider that you'll be able to exit the project. And then there was the story, the why are we doing this? So, it covers all bases. You've got the numbers, the cold, hard facts, and then you've got the inspirational piece of, well, we actually want to make the world better, and we're starting off in this community here, and this is the impact it's going to have, and this is why it's important to us. So I remember somebody saying to me, hearing it in all of these personal development seminars, don't worry about the money will come. And at the time, I was struggling, and I was like, well, where is it? I hope it would come faster. But then what I realized was, over this period of time, is, you know, having that big vision, enrolling people into that big vision is super important. And that's where the money comes. Because then it's a, it's not, you know, help me, give me money. It's like, be part of this, collaborate with this, let's make this happen together. And this is what we're going to achieve from doing this together. And everybody's got their skills and expertise that they can put into it. Some people it's time, some people it's money, some people it's actually doing the work. But, you know, like, we can do this together. And that's the power of what I do.
I remember the first time that I spoke to you in our pre-call, and you said, you know, whatever your elevator pitch is, you know, it's like, you know, developing properties that are sustainable and affordable for double digit return. And I was like, oh, yeah, I would grab that with both hands. Like, that's a no brainer.
Yeah, that's such an exciting combination of ideas. And we know you talk about win-win, and win-win is one of our favorite things also. Is there a good win-win story that you can share with our listeners?
Okay, I'll talk about this one. So part of what I do, while my sort of job is capital raising, the work that I do is actually about connecting with investors and inspiring them to do good things with their money. So back in September 2020, and this was part of my sort of first working with this particular developer, we put together a project. It was a commercial project. It wasn't a high impact project in the way that I do things now, but it was the precursor to that. So he found the project. It was a commercial building. There were five different tenancies in there, but the property was sold as one property. And so he realized that he could sell each of those units separately, a little bit of work in council and development approvals, but he could sell those separately. And so we also worked with a joint venture partner who had a database of she was a commercial real estate educator, and she had a network of investors who were interested in learning more about commercial property and how they could invest in it themselves. But the sort of way that she was doing it was more the, you know, I can be a buyer's agent for you, or I can teach you how to do it, not necessarily, you know, come and invest in my project. So the three of us formed a joint venture, and we did a few webinars to this lady's database. We got 12 investors on board. We needed $1.3 million to purchase this property and do all of the work that was needed. And then the idea was that in 12 months, the property would be sold. Now, in the middle of all of that, and given the experience that I'd had before with joint venture partners and all of that, I thought, well, what's going to be really good here? How can I create a win for the investors? And I realized that it's not just about financially investing. Like, that's one way. But then, you know, sort of how do you get your heart and soul into something? And that's what I like to get people involved in. So what I created was basically an investor network where we had monthly interviews with the developer. So monthly Q&A webinars where the investors could come on, the developer would give a report, the investors could ask questions, and they could actually track that the developer was on target with their milestones as they'd been presented right at the beginning. We also had expert interviews with the consultants that were working on the project as well. So I would interview each week. I'd send out a new interview with the consultants, which again was another way of showing the investors that everything was on track. Because, you know, right at the beginning of the project, it was like, okay, well, how do we get the finance? So I interviewed the finance broker. In the middle of the project, it was like, okay, well, you know, we need a building inspector. So I interviewed the building inspector. At the end of the project, it was, you know, all of that. And then the other thing that we did was have networking events as well, so that the investors could meet up with each other and talk, and they could meet up with us and know that we're real people and all of that. So that I created there, the investor network, was fantastic. And what I realized, it was quite accidental, but a beautiful framework for what later became HIPPI, or high impact property investments, was that those people, those investors, they didn't just put their money in, they invested their time and part of themselves in the project as well. Part of those Q&A webinars, we were able to, like, when problems came up, it was like we're able to brainstorm those solutions to that as well. So the investors felt that their sort of brain power had gone into this too, you know. And then when the project finished, they got a really good return. It was like 30% return on their money over the time period. So we'd built up that trust in that time frame. And then when it came to talk about other projects, which were high impact projects, the numbers stacked up. They knew the team. They'd seen me week in, week out, and sort of got to know me and got to know the developers as well. So when it came time to invest, and even though it was high impact, it wasn't commercial, they came on board as well. So that was sort of moving from the traditional property model to something that now had more benefit for the end users and a greater number of end users. It had benefit for me as, you know, sort of bringing the funding into it. It had benefit for the developer, but benefit for the investors. And then, you know, this is the kind of flagship project that I'm really happy about, which is the 72-room project, which we've got the world-class architect on board with their commitment to net zero. We've got the developer who's committed to providing more sustainable and affordable housing. We've got some of the rooms in that accommodation are going to be suitable for people with disabilities. There's community gardens that are going to be created. There's a shared car.
Car
share, that's it. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
The flooring is not just paving, it's that permeable paving. So there's less stormwater runoff. There's just all sorts of things that wouldn't, like if I'd have tried to pitch that 12 months ago or 18 months ago when we first got together, it just wouldn't have gone down particularly well, I don't think. But because we had that track record, and then over that period of time, even before that period of time, myself and the developer had been talking about, well, how do we create these affordable homes? How do we create these sustainable homes? So even all the while we were doing the traditional project, we were still thinking, how do we do this? How do we do this? But then because we'd proven success here, we were able to bring people on board to our way of thinking. So that's probably the best sort of story I can give you about how to create those win-win-win outcomes, because it's, you know, the money's there, the impact's there, all of it.
Love it. Triple bottom line, people, planet, profit.
Absolutely.
That's the best. So let me ask you this, Dion, would you advise people or do you advise people to start small with a project that they can, you can afford to kind of make mistakes on and learn how to put your team together and have something that you are going to sell, so that your investors do reap the financial rewards of that before going on to kind of a bigger scale project? Because ultimately, like, we don't want to sell our dream project. We want to live in it. So I don't know how we can promise a return on that. But I can see how, like, doing a couple just to understand how the whole thing works kind of
to
makes sense.
Build trust
and to build the networks.
Well, look, there's lots of different ways. So that, you know, that what I've spoken about is my model and how I make it work. In terms of what you're doing, because I understand that you're wanting to create an intentional community that brings sustainability into it, brings affordability into it, brings the resilient communities into it as well. So if I was going to advise you, I would say, of course, I mean, you could do your own small projects, of course. Absolutely, 100%. However, you can also leverage the skills and expertise of somebody else. What's that saying? If you want to go somewhere faster, go alone. If you want to go further, do it with others. So for you, I'd recommend that you find your dream team.
Okay.
However we can.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, there's so many ways to skin this cat as well. Sorry.
The podcast. We're in the podcast. They didn't hear you. It's okay.
Sorry, that's one of the things I really need to drop from my vocabulary. I was a vegan, by the way.
No cats were harmed
in the making of this podcast.
So there's so many ways that you can do this. That's the key message I want to take home.
Yeah.
And one model that I've seen work is a concept called Baggruppen, which is, it's a German word for group homes. So it's a few people coming together to say, well, if we take out the developer, we can come together to build a series of homes. We can pool our money to create something and then save on the, I don't know, whatever the developer margin is, 20%. So basically you end up with a home that's 20% cheaper. So that's a really cool model. Like, you know, maybe you could find organizations that are helping to do that where you are.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it doesn't even need a fancy name. Maybe you just go and find a piece of land with a few people and you all go in and buy it and you set some rules and, you know, this is what we want to do. This is before you buy it, obviously. Yeah, yeah. Set the rules before you buy it.
Yeah.
Make sure your values are aligned before you buy it. And then you go and find something, you buy it. And then, you know, you make sure that again, before you buy it, that you can build certain number of homes on this property. And you just share. Like, yeah, I think that's, there's you know, sort of more advanced ways, but that was probably the easiest place to start.
No, I'm feeling much more confident having spoken to you now for the second time. And, you know, we'll be reaching out to you to join our dream team as we do our values work a little bit more. But I know you've got a book coming out, and I want to talk to you about your book and what you hope, what it's going to be about and what you hope it's going to do.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so the book is about basically all the things that we've spoken about today. So I really look at the problems that investors have before they get involved in ethical property investing. And a lot of that is to do with people definitely need their money to work for them. We're in a society at the moment, inflation is rampant. And so people need their money to work for them. It's not, I'm not talking about philanthropy here. There's a myth that you can't do good and make money. Like, that's not what we're talking about. It's like, you absolutely can. You just need to be able to do it in the right way, following a good structure. So people need their money to work for them. They can see all the challenges that are happening in the world and they feel helpless and powerless to do anything about it. So we're seeing the rise of the housing boom. You know, people, our friends, our communities not having secure homes to live in, people leaving the area, therefore the area becoming less diverse. So, you know, when you have all of this diversity, that's a vibrant community. When people who typically are the lower income earners can't afford to live there and they move on, then that community becomes very homogenous and boring.
Yeah, and you lose the artists, the educators, the musicians, the, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, there's a lot of people who aren't investing in alignment with their values. And when they realize that they're not, it comes as a rude shock. I remember talking to a client who, you know, she was investing with one of the big firms. Again, I'm not going to name them. And realized that they invested in coal mining and companies that promoted child slavery. And, you know, like, or I shouldn't say promoted, I should more say they do work that involves child slavery. So when she realized that, she got a really rude shock. But, you know, she was getting a 12% return on her money in that. And, you know, she wanted to be able to get, again, it comes back to, I need my money to work for me. So those are the problems that we see. And then there's like a lot of shame and guilt around that, because a lot, you know, a lot of the investors that I talk to, they're pretty privileged, in privileged positions, and they really want to help, but they just feel like, you know, oh well, my life's so good, I shouldn't moan, I all of this. So for me, the solutions really are about finding projects that give double digit returns, you know, finding projects that help people to be part of the solution, and finding projects that help people to invest in a way that aligns with their values. So that for me is really about growing wealth, making an impact, and leaving a legacy. Yeah. So, you know, and then I talk about the ethical framework, which I've shared before. And it's really a solutions focused book. It's like, you don't have to be helpless. You can be absolutely, you know, empowered to take action. And there's a quote from Alice Walker, the way that people give away their power is by thinking they don't have any. The power to invest where you spend your money is one of the biggest powers that we have. We can show our displeasure to companies quite easily by not investing with them, not spending with them. We can show our support for companies by spending more money with them. So we actually have a lot of power here. And that's what the book is about. It's really about, well, we can make a difference. There's this myth that you can't create affordable housing, sustainable housing. The book is about busting that myth and saying that's not true. And really it's a book of hope. So That's my mission. And what I want is that investors become inspired to do something. They don't have to come and invest with me. I'd love them to, but they don't have to. They can start something themselves. They can work with people that they know, like, and trust. I don't care. But if everybody starts investing in properties and looking to how many people can I serve rather than how much can I take for myself, the world is instantly going to be better. And whether that's, you know, building a granny flat in your backyard, whether that's, you know, investing into something, whether that's the next house you buy, you as an investment property, you make sure that a single woman and a child can live there. Or, do you know what I mean? Like, there's so much we can do. We are so much more powerful than we think. And that's what this book is about. And that's what I hope to share with people. Like, let's do something about this, because we don't have a lot of time. And the backstory to this as well is that if we don't do anything, if we leave the inequalities in place as they are, we are setting ourselves up for a fall. None of us are immune to this. It's not somebody else's problem. It's our problem. So then we have to be part of the solution.
Love it. Absolutely.
Way to stick the landing.
Yeah. So those of you who are listening, you know, definitely make sure you subscribe to the newsletter, follow us on social media. So you know when Dr. Dion Payne's book comes out, The Ethical Investor,
The
Ethical Property Investor.
Yeah. We will be trumpeting that to the heavens.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes.
We'll be reading it. Dog-earing
and
it.
And gifting it.
Outlining it.
Yes.
Yes. Absolutely. Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this podcast and helping us think through and kind of bust. I've been busting my own internal myths just listening to you, and I'm late to the game of understanding how to make money work for me and for the rest of my community and for the rest of the world. So I really appreciate it. I've learned a lot.
Me too. Yeah, fantastic. I'm very excited, and I feel more confident than ever that it's possible for us to do the thing that we're envisioning and make a positive impact.
Absolutely. How can folks find you, find out about your projects, maybe become an investor? Where should they go?
Okay, well, they can go to my website, which is highimpactpropertyinvestments.com.au. It's an Australian site, but we do work all around the world. So we have developers in the US that we're working with as well, who are doing some really cool things. And I'd love to be able to support them too.
Great. Say that website one more time.
Sure thing. highimpactpropertyinvestments.com.au.
Great. Great. And of course, we'll have that in the show notes along with the ethical investment framework. I love that.
Ooh,
I love
that.
That's a mnemonic. Anyway, we'll put it on the show notes. So please go check those out. Dr. Payne, Dion, thank you so much for just showing up in your special way with your superpower.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for having me. Thank you very much for sharing this platform so we can get the message out to more and more people.
Absolutely. We hope and trust that you got something of value and something actionable to aid and inspire you on your sustainability journey. We invite you to continue with us on this expedition into positive impact and more satisfactory, satisfying, and sustainable living.
Subscribe to the twice monthly newsletter. It's short and sweet, full of useful resources, and of course, my favorite part, a gratuitous podcast picture. And remember to join the Here Together Club on Clubhouse.
You can also engage with us on Twitter @HereTogether1. We'll be there sharing climate news and really important photos of sustainable alpaca farms.
Yay.
Go ahead and tag us on tweets that you think should get more attention. Again, we're building a community of newly empowered local climate action takers and personal sustainability makers.
Together, we got this.
The Here Together podcast is a project of Rocket Feather Creative.